against the tradition of this workshop, I had to identify myself as a physicist, so I know much less about cancer than many of you do. So here's what I do know, what I think I know about cancer, is the tumor growth can be separated into three phases. The avascular phase grows into a solid mass of cells that does not have vasculature, and it typically has this ring structure of a necrotic core and a very thin proliferating surface layer and separated by this quiescent core. And then angiogenesis has to happen in order for the tumor to go beyond its saturation size to become further grow and become malignant. And vascular stage, the cancer cells can become invasive and potentially develop secondary tumor somewhere else. And we have modeled along these three lines, the solid tumor, meaning avascular tumor growth, and angiogenesis, and then we embedded some vasculature, very idealized, simplified vasculature into the tumor to see vascular tumor growth and the effects of chemotherapy. So before I go on talking about the specific models and our results, I'd like to step back and talk a little bit about the modeling methods. All these cancer as and development, wound healing, morphogenesis, host pathogen interactions, many problems that we care about, at least I care about, involve many cells at a tissue level, organ level, systems level. How do we model that? There are many ways of mathematical modeling or computational models that we have seen so far. At the one extreme, you have macroscopic continuous models for these kind of problems where you cannot really take into account the variability between cells, how cells interact with each other. And on the other extreme, which we haven't seen much here, is the signaling networks, genetic regulations, which is becoming more and more popular now because of the availability of this outpour of data. But even with a very, very complex network, you can't even describe the single cell, right? Because of the complexity of the problem. Let alone this kind of complex interaction between cell populations. So I hope this talk will demonstrate to you that it's maybe not such a bad idea to start from the cell level, to describe the cell behaviors at a phenomenological level. So there are many ways to model such cell-based model, and the basic unit for this cell-based model is cell. It can be cancer cells, endothelial cells, extracellular matrix, or interstitial fluid. Those can be treated as some kind of a cell. And cells can have different phenotypes. They can be liver cell versus heart cell. They can be quiescent versus proliferating. And they interact through effective energy and or local rules. And the model that I've been using is the cellular parts model. And James Glacier sitting here is the first one who started using it. The cellular parts model divides the lattice into domains, and domains of these numbers is a cell. So here is a schematic, it's a two-dimensional schematic of three cells. A whole cluster of number three is my cell number three. So number three interacts with number five at the surface. They have some kind of adhesive interaction. And the cells also keep their volume. And this kind of adhesive interaction and the fact that they keep their volume is described by this effective energy. The numbers on the lattice, if they are the same, this term is zero because of this delta function. So there's no energy cost between inside the cell. If they are different, that's describing the cellular interfaces, the cell membrane, that you will have a type-dependent, cell type-dependent energy. And the, if you just have this term, the whole pattern evolves to just one cell, because if you try to minimize the total energy, the minimal configuration will be just one single domain. But the cells have their volumes, and we do that by adding this constraint that the current cell volume is constrained by a target volume elastically. Any deviation from the volume contributes to the total energy. So in order to keep that energy down, the cells maintain a more or less maintain a volume around this target volume. So with this model alone, just this type-dependent adhesion energy and the volume constraint, this model is already capable in modern many processes, including cell sorting and some developmental morphogenesis problems. For tumor growth, we added intracellular signaling network to determine how cells decide to divide or how cells decide to undergo quiescence. That's the cell cycle regulatory network. And the cells, the rate the proteins get turned on and off is influenced by the local growth factors and inhibitors. The local microenvironment is described by continuous equations as a field on this whole simulation domain. So we considered oxygen, we considered glucose, lactate, which is the metabolic product of glucose, growth factors and growth inhibitors. Adding additional rules such as how cells become quiescent or how cells shed from the surface, we can model the spheroid tumor growth. The cell line that I model is a mouse carcinoma of EMT0R6. Doesn't mean much. But the nice thing about it is the data is available at Los Alamos. Jim Fryer's lab is still working on collecting growth data from spheroids. This is under the condition of this is a tumor spheroid experiment is when you put tumor cells in culture, where you keep the culture, the medium, oxygen concentration, glucose concentration, all the medium refresh constantly, so you basically keep a constant boundary condition for your chemicals. But the tumor grow, divide, and increase in volume, maintaining its interior microenvironment. So that's a very nice in vitro tumor growth environment model, because you basically take out the environmental variables, but you keep the microenvironmental information within the tumor. We the model, our model basically, very similar to yesterday, some simulations we've seen yesterday, that in time growing from this proliferating cell into layered structure. And this is done at this condition in the medium around the cell. With the data, we can compare how this simulation growth, the tumor volume, compared with the experiment. The solid symbols are two sets of experiment. Each data point is averaged over 200 spheroids. So this is actually a fit with to the experimental data in order to determine the experimental modeling parameters. The two key modeling parameters in our model are the necrotic condition, threshold oxygen glucose level for the cells to undergo necrosis, and the unknown, the diffusion coefficients for the unknown growth factor inhibitor that determines the protein regulatory protein expression level. So in making this fit, we found that the necrosis condition for tumor cells is such. This is compared to the normal believed value, this predicted value is lower, and was a surprise to my biologist collaborator. He said this seems to suggest that tumor cells can survive a much harsher microenvironment than normal cells. And we've also found out the diffusion coefficient for the growth factor inhibitor has to be in this range of 10 to the minus 4, minus 5 centimeter squared per hour, which corresponds to the molecular weight of this range. This suggests to the experimentalist what kind of molecules to look for. And we still don't know what they are, but the suspicious ones fit within this range. So, within the tumor. But they're not very different from outside the tumor as well, in the medium. So with those parameters fixed, in vitro, the spheroid experiment in suspension, with those parameters fixed by the tumor growth volume, the cell number, the tumor cell number also came out very nicely. Cell cycle fraction, how many cells are in G1 phase, in S phase, and G2 plus M phase, also came out very nicely. These are independent measures of the volume measurement that we use to fit data, our parameters. And then, by as in the experiment, we change the experimental condition. With this set of parameters, that we can still reproduce the tumor volume growth. And if we change again, we can still reproduce. So we seem to have found a set of parameters within this model that can reproduce the growth for this particular cell line. And with that, we may be able to use this model to investigate the detailed mechanisms for tumor growth, how microenvironment affects like the inhibitor level, affects the tumor growth. How much of the growth or quiescence or cell death is due to the inhibitor? How much of it is due to mechanics? In our model, for example, a cell is trying to grow in amongst all the cells who are also trying to grow. It might become quiescent because it cannot double its volume. So we can investigate all these individual mechanisms or in combination of these mechanisms to see why tumor growth reaches saturation. And Jim Fryer's lab, we still have new data coming out about this cell cycle protein in spheroids and different cell lines, some knockouts versus wild type, different cell line growth data. And with such a model, we hope to be able to maybe identify, by fitting to the growth curve, identify what the differences between this knockout versus the wild type growth. And angiogenesis is the topic that I'm going to talk about today, which marks the vital transition between malignant to between benign and malignant, the transition between this avascular to vascular tumor growth. We can also imagine this process as multi-scale. The cells have to respond to the growth factors through these signaling pathways. The cells have to interact with each other. They have to interact with their environment. They have to grow, they have to divide, they have to migrate. So all this is happening at several scales, and this is how we treat this, how we view this problem. A hypoxic tumor cells sending out this VEGF vascular endothelial growth factors into the surrounding structure, the stromal structure. And here is the parent blood vessel. The blood vessel lining endothelial cells are becoming activated by binding through binding of VEGF, and they become active by proliferating and migrating toward the source of the, toward the higher concentration of VEGF. And we do describe this stromal area as extracellular matrix and tissue field environment, not as a vacuum. So this is what it sees, what it looks like in our model. Parent blood vessel, which is unseen, but there's an endothelial cell already sitting here. Here's the tumor, which is the source of this vascular endothelial growth factor, which is sitting on this whole surface. The blue squares are tissue cells, normal tissue cell, and the blue yellow fibers are the matrix, extracellular matrix fibers, with green as the interstitial fluid. So this is a highly simplified but rather realistic stromal environment that we have some basic ingredients. So in here, in this model, we have endothelial cell, we have the normal cell, we have extracellular matrix, we have fluid, interstitial fluid. And the cells and matrix interact via adhesion. They have a special adhesion strength with the matrix fibers compared to the cell-cell adhesion and cell-fluid adhesion. The cells can secrete matrix fibers as well as degrade matrix fibers, and they remodel the matrix fiber. But as we have seen from Lang's talk, that as cells walk on these fibers, they tuck on the fibers and remodel the fiber. We oriented the fiber, which we have not done in our model. Cells also respond to VEGF, the growth factor, by binding to it, by becoming activated, and there are phenotype selections in the front of this sprout development. There's a tip. It's considered a very distinct phenotype because they send out pseudopods, pseudopodia to it, and not proliferating. And then we also have proliferating versus dormant phenotypes. The cells are chemotaxing, migrating up chemical gradient of the VEGF. Chemotaxis is modeled through this another effective energy in a cell model that we can choose the chemical potential values such that they migrate, such that higher chemical is preferred energetically. Higher chemical concentration is preferred energetically. The VEGF then is diffusing in the structure, in the stromal area. It decays and it's being bound to the cell. The binding function is the cell can bind as much molecules, VEGF molecules, available until all the receptors are saturated. So this is what it looks like in a two-dimensional simulation. I have to say that it's really quasi 2D, that there's the cells are on top of this matrix. They don't have to replace the matrix fibers. So it looks quite realistic when we asked the experimentalist. And one thing that we tried to compare with the experiment is the VEGF gradient profile. Until very recently, VEGF has been believed to be freely diffusing in the stromal area. But our recent experiment has shown that more of them are actually matrix bound. And it's still controversial which one is causing the cells to become activated. But here's two tests. If the VEGF is freely diffusible in the stromal area, because the diffusion happens is so much faster than all the other processes, it would set up. Any disturbance to the diffusion would be smoothed out. It would set up this kind of a very smooth gradient. If it were bound, the VEGF was bound to the matrix, and only the cell degradation of the matrix could release the VEGF locally and be bound by the cells, it would set up this kind of a deep gorges where the cells have been. And this is what you see in these two situations. With these deep gorges, the tip cells could sense a very steep directional gradient ahead of it, and that's the directional guide, and they can pull the whole sprout ahead, resulting in this very thin and narrow sprout. If it's this very smooth gradient, the cells don't have a very strong directional guide. When the cells become proliferated, they can expand, and so you have this very swollen blood vessel or sprout. I wouldn't call it blood vessel because there's no blood, there's no hole in it. And this is compares nicely with Louisa Aristi's experiment. This is the control, normal angiogenesis when you see this kind of blood vessels. In when you have matrix-bound VEGF isoform 164, you see this kind of very thin and narrow blood vessels of sprouts. When they cleaved this 164 into the isoform of 113, a smaller molecule that freely diffusible, they found this much fatter sprout. So in this simulation that I showed you, sorry. I will. Sorry, I forgot to mention that in this simulation, this is a very phenomenological description. I call the cell that's closest to my right boundary, the tip cell. It's responsible for migrating. It's not proliferating. And I say, I ask the cells that's right behind the tip. Okay, I say, you are right behind the tip and you should proliferate. So you see all the new cells are added right behind the tip. That's driving the sprout expansion. But it's controversial in the literature where this proliferating region is. In some literature, some experiments show they are proliferating right at the base of the sprout. Some say it's some distance from the sprout, from the tip. This is right behind the tip, and this is right at the tip. So we basically asked in many simulations, asked them, you are proliferating or you are proliferating at the different regions of the sprout. And this is what you can see. The average extension speed depends on the proliferating region. And if the tip is proliferating at the same time, the two functions interfere such that you don't get a very high extension speed. And then, of course, for all these simulations, we have to run it many times in order to get the good statistics to narrow down the error bar. And then we see this. And I believe this was the very first simulation that of branching that we don't have to specify a branching probability or any branching rules. Branching without specifying.
What I'm saying, using the CDE, instead of using the FACS model, which is a very interesting approach, you can use the CDE and use the chemoplastic, you can get similar results. I saw that in the paper in the Bruce McFarland by Howard.
So within this model, since we saw branching and we basically investigated what caused branching, it appears that if you have any inhomogeneous background, if you have any heterogeneity in your stromal area, you would have branching. And if you have very homogeneous background, you cannot get branching. So this basically is proposing maybe an additional biophysical mechanism for branching, that heterogeneity in the microenvironment is sufficient to induce branching.
You have different cell adhesion because the different individual cells and the
tissue. I don't think so. So we have cell adhesion to each other. Endothelial cells adhere to each other. They have certain adhesion properties to the normal tissue cell. They have a different adhesion constant to the matrix fiber and to the fluid.
Let's say the matrix of the normal tissue, then if the adhesions are not the same, then the
right.
Cells, so
right. That's part of the heterogeneity in the That's part of the heterogeneity in the stromal environment.
That's not the reason that you can't see. There should be
Now if we could see branching, it probably wouldn't be too surprising to you that if we put several of them, you can see them merging. This is just happened. But this is, it looks nice. The pictures look okay. And it can even compare some aspects with the experiment. But this is not right because all this growth is driven by the proliferation. And it takes, we are looking at the normal tissue environment. So you are never very far from, in a normal tissue, you are never very far from a microvessel. The oxygen diffusion distance is about 100 microns. So we're not modeling the kind of a corneal experiment where you see lots of branching over a long distance. We are modeling the normal tissue environment in the 100 micron scale. The cells are about 10 microns in dimension. So it takes about 10 divisions to reach to make a sprout across this scale. Each cell cycle is maybe 10 hours. Let's say it's 10 hours. So this sprout extension is at the speed of one cell generation per hour, which is much slower than what's observed. That's 5 to 10 microns per hour. It's about an order of magnitude slower than what should be observed. And it was a lot of pain trying to figure out why, because we put in all the relevant parameters that we could think of. And it turned out that it's this retraction. We didn't model the cell retraction properly. If we let one single cell migrate, not proliferate, it would not detach from the left border. So once we realized that, we fixed the problem. And this, when I showed this to Charlie, who is a biologist looking under the microscope all the time, he loved it. He said, this looked very realistic as a cell migration on the matrix. But blood vessels don't do that. How do we, and this is migrating at the right speed, at this 5 to 10 microns per hour. So what happens next is when the cells move away from the blood vessel, there would be cells have already proliferated along the mother blood vessel that can be recruited to fill the hole, fill the gap. So now you have this recruitment and you have a sprout developing by the migration mostly and the proliferation already happening at the parent vessel. And with this model, now we can have also develop this very complex sprout structure without with the quantitative migration speed, correct migration speed as well. And this is an additional movie that shows at some point in some simulations, you can even see this guy piggyback on the sprout, migrating along this sprout, which is being observed quite extensively in Charlie Little's movies as well.
So the point is migration is quite fast and proliferation is slow.
Migration is happening at about 5 microns to 10 microns per hour. And proliferation is happening at 10 to 12 hours. So within this range of 100 microns, you probably get at most one division. And now we not only can quantitatively compare the expansion speed, we can also compare this kind of cell elongation. The cell tip cells elongate to up to 50 microns because of their extensive migration. And this. I'll show you. So here is one thing we tried. We can vary the matrix density. This matrix is static, right? The only thing we vary is the density. From very low density, where the cells become unviable, basically they cannot survive in this kind of shape, or very high density, they cannot move at all. In this region, they have very high extension speed and some region that has higher branching probabilities than others. We can see this, actually there's a sort of optimal range of matrix density that corresponds to the physiological range of matrix density. And then we can see with matrix density, sorry, then your computer is too slow. So we can see with matrix density, the if without degradation, we'll have interruption of angiogenesis. But with matrix degradation, you can have sprout extension. So and you can have promotion of branching with matrix degradation at certain range. So this is the effect of matrix density, matrix degradation. And then we can, being the entropic physicist, we can also model very physical situations, biological situations, by setting up very artificial matrix patterns to examine how matrix alignment influence the sprout extension and the cellular elongation shape, etc. And here's just one example of an experiment done on a patent substrate where you put one cell, it expands to this shape, and this is our simulation. And so far, I've been calling the tip cell, you migrate, and the proliferating cell, you proliferate. But that's not good enough. The cells should be able to do it by itself. And so we incorporated this intracellular signaling network. The RTK pathway is the VEGF binding pathway, the growth factor binding pathway, and the integrin pathway leading to the actin activities, which is our motility phenotype, and their crosstalks. This is the bare minimum. This is the essential network for these two pathways and their crosstalks. And it took a lot of, again, it was a lot of pain to sprout the literature in order to construct this network. And from the literature, there's also this very conflicting account between this RES and ROL. Some say it's ROL A inhibits REC, or some points to different experiments points to both mutual inhibition, and even another one points to one activation versus the other inhibition. So we're going to examine all these three. But we call this one our baseline model. So most of the simulation I'm going to show is through this baseline model. So because we don't have all the rates, we treat it as a Boolean network. Yeah, all the proteins are either on or off. The input is receptor and integrin. So I have a 2-bit input signal, and I have a 3-bit output signal, which is proliferation, apoptosis, and motility. So I have a 2-bit input and a 3-bit output. And we can do this, we can write down the stochastic equation for this signaling network, and the result can be summarized by this simple table, 2-bit input and 3-bit output. And remind you, the middle one is apoptosis. So if you have apoptosis turned on, the cell is dying regardless of the others. So all this, you see the apoptosis phenotype. But all, over on this column, you can find proliferation, proliferation and migration, and quiescence and migration phenotypes. So we incorporate this into the this network itself is quite interesting. It's very robust to internal noises. So you can turn the proteins on and off with noise, but the outcome is quite robust. But it's very sensitive to external signals. You can turn on here. I turn off, I think this is the integrin signal. I turn it off. As the signal switches through the network, you have the apoptosis turned on. This is the, here's the, when I turn off the integrin, and this is artificial unit time after, this is proliferation. This is apoptosis, right? The cell become apoptotic. And we also examined the feedback schemes and show that the feedback scheme number two, one activate, the other inhibit, is cannot be possible for the cells because the cell is just not behaving the right way. And then we incorporated this signaling network. Now it's a truly multi-scale model. It has this chemical signal, and then the cells use the chemical signal as well as its local matrix information, go through the signaling network calculation, look up the table, and pick a phenotype. And now we have this phenotype determined for the cells on the lattice. The Monte Carlo steps update the numbers on the lattice. It goes on to update the VEGF profile. If I were to show you a movie, it would look remarkably the same, similar to to the one I just showed you. But now, I didn't define any tip cell or proliferating cell or quiescent cell. They all came out by themselves through the local information. And we see that as the sprout develops, the tip is the front of the sprout consists of mostly this proliferating and migrating phenotype. And around the branching point, you have a lot of proliferation. So the proliferation actually occurs in multiple locations along the sprout, but if you have a cluster of proliferating cells, it tends to induce branching. So, and then we can vary the matrix density to see the extension speed, and we can measure the how likely they are to branch, how fat or thin the vessels are, trying to quantify such a pattern, and hopefully to find experimentalists to have data to compare it to. And branching, anastomosis, all these emerging patterns also are preserved in this multi-scale model where the cells determine their own fate. And this is just additional. When we extend the simulation domain, you could see more branching happening, maybe mimicking the so-called brush border effect when you see more blood vessels near the tumor boundary. So all these are still very new, and we're trying to figure out what all these simulations imply. So if you have some ideas and thoughts, I'd like to talk to you. One thing that we believe such a model can do is to potentially point out pro-angiogenesis or anti-angiogenesis targets. For example, if we tune the threshold integrin signal, we can change the apoptosis rate for the endothelial cells. If we tune the threshold level for the growth factors, we can accordingly also change the apoptosis level or proliferating level for the cells. One thing that's been pointed out at this conference is the recently approved Avastin, which is a VEGF receptor binder. It blocks the VEGF receptor too. That's a very similar effect on the one thing. That's one way to tune the receptor threshold level in our model. So I have talked to you about this cell-based multi-scale model, and I call it a framework because I believe it's not only applicable to this tumor growth angiogenesis, it's probably applicable to many other tissue level, organ level problems. And we have tested or generated several hypotheses about angiogenesis. In particular, we looked at diffusible versus matrix bound VEGF. We looked at topography of extracellular matrix density. And we can link the phenotype of cells to the local signals. And that's it. And I'd like to thank Jim Fryer, who's my experimental collaborator for the tumor spheroid, and Amy Bauer, whose thesis work was mostly I talked about angiogenesis. Thank you.